This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. When times get tough, people tend to want strong leadership. We have a couple of stories about this in today's program. In America, the political establishment is waking up to the reality that Donald Trump is a man to be reckoned with. He has far more public support than a lot of pundits thought. He's steamrolling his way to the Republican nomination. We're going to talk about what's behind this trend. We'll put it in context with history and with trends in Europe to give us an idea of where this will take us. In Russia, you have tremendous support for one Vladimir Putin, a prime example of a classic strongman. We're going to talk about how Putin is using religion as a means of shoring up his popularity and how religion has actually become an authoritarian tool for the Russian government. In our third segment, we're going to leave the world of politics and geopolitics and talk about your back. Trumpet Hour has your back. If you've ever reached down to pick something up off the floor and you had your back give out, you know that you miss it when it's gone. We're going to talk with chiropractor Larry Lowen about what to do if you find yourself in this situation. And we'll conclude by talking about why people today aren't marrying as much as they used to. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. For the last 7.5 years, America has had a president who is taking more and more executive power. He's pushed Congress aside. He's exceeded the constitutional limits of his office. He's turned the presidency into far more authoritarian role than the founders ever intended. Now, in the current presidential campaign, we have Donald Trump. This man is having enormous success among a lot of Americans. And he's presenting himself as a man who can get things done, who's going to make things happen. He's making tremendous promises about his huge plans. And really, it's almost like another version, maybe quite different version, of the same kind of executive power that we've seen for the past 7.5 years. I have with me here trumpet writer Andrew Miller to help put this in context. Hello, Andrew.
Yes, good to be here. It is... very shocking. Like you said, for 7.5 years, we've had this president who's pushed the power of the executive branch far beyond anything it's been in the past. And a lot of Republican commentators have been looking forward to the day when they'd get a more constitutionally minded president to start scaling this back. And then the Republican Party is gone. And at least as of Super Tuesday, it looks like Donald Trump is going to be the most likely Republican nominee unless something drastic changes.
Right. They're really trying to figure out how they can stop this from happening. But
it definitely looks like that's the way it's going. And I watched some of the Super Tuesday coverage last week. And there's just one of the most shocking things to me is after Trump won so many states, he gave up a press conference, and one of the journalists asked him how he thought his relationship with Congress would be, and I actually brought the Trump quote to his response, but he said, "I'm going to get along great with Congress. Paul Ryan, I don't know him well, but I'm sure going to get along great with him. And if I don't, he's going to have to pay a big price."
Right.
And it just...
This is really one of several comments that he's made. I mean, I've been hearing it, especially since he's been racking up the victories in these primaries, that really should give us concern about how he's going to exercise executive power.
Right. I mean, obviously you have this very constitutional idea that's very simple, is that Congress makes laws, the court interprets laws, and the president enforces those laws. And the current administration's blurred that distinction to where you just get this chief executive that can ram through almost any part of his agenda he wants. And even though a Trump presidency would probably make very different decisions than the Obama presidency, it does look like he's still looking to use the same strong arm tactics to circumvent the legislative branch if he feels it's necessary.
He definitely doesn't seem interested in how he can fulfill the constitutional description of the presidency. He wants to be the CEO of America.
Absolutely. That's definitely my impression. And it's actually interesting just to look back as their commentators keep referring to him as like far-right leader or like a right-wing demagogue, and maybe they have some points with that. One thing a lot of people may not remember is actually just some interesting history about how even the terms right-wing and left-wing got injected into our political discussions.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about that in the Week in Review.
Right, we did. We were talking more about how that applies to Europe, but it also is applying here in that these are really relics left over. This terminology is relics left over from the French Revolution, when the aristocratic pro-Catholic supporters of the king in the feudal system sat on the right side of the chamber, and then these radical revolutionaries in the First Estate who were opposed to atheism and secularism and socialism and forcing all people to be not only born equal but equal regardless of their actions throughout their life, sat on the left side of the chamber. And from those wellsprings, you'd gotten this very socialist communist movement that evolved out of the French Revolution that became known as the left wing. And then you got this more monarchist, which eventually became more like nationalist, populist movement that came out of the right wing. But in America, I mean, we came across the Atlantic to get away from all that nonsense and set up something that was completely different, where it wasn't. The power didn't belong to the king, like these right-wing parties were saying, and it didn't belong to the socialist big government state, like the left-wing parties are stating. The government was rooted in a constitution with separation of powers that kept the government small, limited, and non-intrusive into people's lives.
And a government by the people.
Right, and based on, like I said, based on elections and voting, that the people could run their government, but it was also a meritocracy, to where people, based on their work ethic and their creativity, they were able to excel. And it really wasn't till the 1930s when some of these socialist ideas started moving into American politics that they were very proud of their left-wing label. So they started calling anyone who opposed them right-wing, even though the monarchist nationalists who opposed them in Europe had absolutely nothing in common with the constitutional conservatives that opposed them in the United States. And so now that term right wing's become very confusing, as you'll hear people refer to Adolf Hitler as right wing, and you'll hear people refer to like Ron Paul as right wing, even though Hitler was like this totalitarian dictator. And Ron Paul, I mean, if the man became any smaller government, he'd practically be an anarchist.
Mm-hmm. So, but what we're seeing in Donald Trump is this manifestation of an idea that we really do want to invest our trust in a man who is a mover and a shaker, and he can get things done. And in a way, it seems like President Obama has kind of opened the door for more of this kind of thinking. He's almost conditioned Americans to be more comfortable with a very strong executive.
Right. He definitely has. He's changed President Obama's changed the whole political discourse to where people, they're looking to a strong man who can circumvent Congress to do what's best for what they think's best for the lower classes if he needs to. And now that people have gotten used to that, even the other side of the political spectrum is almost looking to their own strong man. And obviously, I think I mentioned before, a Trump presidency and Obama presidency would make very different decisions, but they're both very authoritarian, big government style people in violation of the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, so you're talking about some of the comparisons with what we see over in Europe, and what's interesting is here we see this on the Republican side. He really seems to be pretty closely paralleling what we're seeing in a lot of the right-wing parties in Europe right now, where it's this anti-immigration, strong nationalistic type of sentiment that's propelling candidates like Marine Le Pen in France Viktor Orban in Hungary. There does seem to be a certain common cause there.
It definitely does. It looks like I don't really actually know much about like the ideological roots of where Donald Trump got his ideas. Maybe he thought about
No one does,
but it is shockingly similar to what we see in Europe, because in Europe, with the exception of maybe a few political parties in Britain, there really isn't this very small, limited government idea. Both the right wing and the left wing are big government, and actually both the right wing and the left wing are kind of for the welfare state. The only difference, man, is that the right wing tends to be more nationalist and the left wing tends to be more internationalist. And especially now in America, we've got like the Bernie Sanders campaign, who he's very openly said that he's a European style democratic socialist, starting Denmark and Scandinavia as his examples. But Trump seems to be very similar to like the European right wing. I mean, strong welfare, big government, but very like strong military, national greatness, anti-immigrant rhetoric as well.
There have been some who have compared Donald Trump to Silvio Berlusconi in Italy.
Right. It's actually, I saw that a couple weeks ago, and that's actually, I think, quite an amazing comparison. Because before that, I'd heard a few people compare Trump to Mussolini in Italy. And Mussolini definitely was this right-wing populist who that combined socialism from the left wing with nationalism for the right wing, and then had this abominable hybrid ideology that he called fascism. And to a certain extent, Trump is combining left-wing socialism with right-wing nationalism, but definitely not as extreme of versions of those two ideologies as Mussolini. So the Mussolini was a little, that comparison was a little overblown. But the Berlusconi analogy, which also had a, like, who's almost like a much lighter version of Mussolini, really does, it's amazing. Some of they were both television media moguls before coming to power. They both became popular because they weren't afraid to say outlandish things and wouldn't back off from their comments.
Right, but a lot of things Berlusconi said, it's kind of similar in terms of the cult of personality. He had a real reputation as a womanizer and just a self-made man, that type of thing.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. He made all sorts of, just like sexist comments and other things that were very politically incorrect. Anyone else would have had to have been forced to back away from those comments by the media for saying, but both Trump and Berlusconi, they haven't backed away from anything. Once it's left of their mouth, they're standing by it.
And we're looking at what happened in Italy. We get a good idea of what happens when you basically prioritize these kinds of personality traits over political substance.
Right. Berlusconi, I don't know if he used that exact phrase, but he also kind of was on this platform of, make Italy great again. And he didn't make Italy great again, but it's...
Right.
But he did do a lot of big crackdowns. I remember back 2007, 2008, writing an article on Berlusconi's product in Italy, where he was limiting more than five protesters couldn't gather in one place as an anti-riot measure, and just cracking down on free speech and things like that, which Trump's made similar comments himself on going after journalists or things like that.
Right, he made that comment after a recent primary victory where he said he wanted to expand the libel laws so that the press wouldn't be able to write these hit pieces against him. He talked about making life very difficult for Jeff Bezos and Amazon because they were trying to increase their political influence. So, similar types of authoritarian trends. And what's interesting is just how much we're seeing this cycle. We're coming back to some of these same ideas of the past because people don't know enough to recognize something that's already failed when they see it.
Right. They think this is, and I know when they break down the demographics, I say that Trump's major supporters are working class Republicans who don't have a college degree. And
well, he's
that's definitely I'm far from me to claim that you need a college degree to be educated. There's a lot of great self-educated people, but it just does seem like a lot of the people that are really going after him that are they like the macho image and the Make America Great campaign, but they actually haven't looked into the political ideologies deep enough to realize that, hey, this isn't new. This has been tried before.
Right. Yeah, it's just really like the same story that is told over and over, that what has happened in America over the last 200 years has really been an extraordinary historical anomaly in terms of the success of this nation based on the government that was established from the very beginning and the freedom that it engendered and that it created for individuals all over the country, and the fact that we're rushing into this more of this big government model and the strongman model, it's really an extraordinary moment in history, isn't it?
No, absolutely. It just is saddening to see that. I mean, I guess for the past 50 years, it seemed like the political argument in America has been limited government versus big government. And now, at least as of Super Tuesday, it looks like both parties have taken on the big government platform, and there's no one who's defending this ideals of the Founding Fathers anymore.
We've been talking with Andrew Miller. He's working on an article about this. You can watch for that in the coming days on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate your time, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Friedrich Nietzsche famously said, "God is dead." The world was moving into a post-religious world, turning its back on the backward superstitions of the past, or so they thought. But in today's world, religion is very much alive. You're seeing religion playing an increasing role in politics. The driving forces in the Middle East are all motivated by religion. In the U.S., Mr. Trump is making a big show of how religious he is and the support that he has among evangelicals. The Vatican is very involved in politics within Europe. In Russia, for decades, it was under the atheistic rule of the communists, but that isn't the case today. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin is using religion to cement his power, and he's doing a really good job of it. I have trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques here to talk about this. Hello, Jeremiah.
Hello there.
So the latest story is it's actually becoming a crime not to be religious in Putin's Russia. Maybe you can tell us about this.
Yeah, that's what it looks like. A Russian man went on trial last week, and he's facing up to 1 year in prison because he denied the existence of God. This man's name is Viktor Krasnov. He's from southwestern Russia, and he made the atheistic statements on a social network called VK.com. It's kind of like the Russian version of Facebook or something along those lines. And Krasnov is a 38-year-old man, and in that statement, he said, "The Bible is, quote, a collection of Jewish fairy tales. There is no God." So these are the kind of statements that are not at all uncommon for us to see from atheists on the internet here in the United States, and really it would not have been very uncommon at all in Russia either, up until just a few years ago. But in 2013, Russia passed a batch of what are sometimes called anti-blasphemy laws, and these laws outlaw the kinds of statements that Krasnov made. These laws were passed just after a Russian punk band performed some songs in Moscow's largest and most famous cathedral, and some of these songs were very critical of Putin, and some of them were just critical in a more general way of religion. And two of the band members were jailed because of that performance, and then the government started working on these blasphemy laws. So in this new case, Viktor Krasnov was charged by Russia's investigative committee, which is the equivalent of the FBI, basically, with, quote, offending believers' feelings. Offending believers' feelings. To me, that sounds like the kind of charge that you would find in the laws of an Islamist country.
Or on an American university
campus. Yeah, that's true. That's true. But this is in Russia. It's supposed to be this this place that's full of tough people and not a lot of political correctness. But Russia is also overwhelmingly Christian. Somewhere around 70% of Russian citizens are members of the Russian Orthodox Church. And under Putin, it's becoming quite unwise for any Russian not to be a good Russian Orthodox Christian, as this new case shows. Putin has really been forging a deep alliance with the church for several years. And at this point, Putin's government protects the church. That's a big part of this new case against Viktor Krasnov. And in exchange, the church protects Putin. And it gives him kind of a divine stamp of approval for anything he wants to do. It's really interesting to me that up until 2012, Vladimir Putin had never really played up his faith very much. But that year, tens of thousands of Russians, mostly very liberal ones, protested his return to the presidency. And so Putin responded to all those protests by leaning on the very conservative appeal of the Russian Orthodox Church. So he kind of said, oh, you don't like me? Well, that means you don't like the Russian Orthodox Church. That means you don't like God. He basically portrayed himself as a devout Christian, a Christian much beloved by the leaders of the Orthodox Church. And that way he was able to paint all of his opponents as these lawless, godless liberals.
So you're not suggesting that that Putin's appeal to the Russian Orthodox Church was less than sincere?
It might have had a tincture of political motivation to it. Time will tell.
But whether or not it was, the effect was that it really turned a whole lot of people to his favor in a much more loyalist kind of way.
Yes. Yeah, his somewhat sudden piety proved to be a very powerful tool to help him to suppress his opposition within Russia. But it has also helped him outside of Russia. The upper echelons of the Russian Orthodox Church have given that stamp of approval to just about all of Putin's expansionist foreign policy moves. They espouse the independence of Georgia's pro-Russian breakaway states. They say that Putin was right to have invaded Ukraine. They say that Putin was right with his intervention there in Syria. The church has essentially said that whatever Putin does, God is on his side.
Yeah, well, we were talking with Richard Palmer recently about the fact that the Russian Orthodox Patriarch, Kirill, that some say he's a former KGB agent, that he's essentially a tool for the Russian government. He's been involved with the federal security services in Russia, and that it's really like there was this meeting between Patriarch Kirill and the Pope recently, and they say basically that it was Putin who orchestrated that. So yes. There's a lot of interconnection between the church and, there's no separation between church and state in this instance.
Yeah, not at all. Not at all. And one other really fascinating aspect of this is that just as Putin has cozied up to the conservative church in order to work against liberals within Russia, he has also leaned toward the church in order to paint Russia on the global scene as a defender of traditional values in a world that's led by this morally bankrupt United States, morally broken Europe. So it's an exact reversal,
right,
as you mentioned at the beginning there, of what we saw in the Cold War era. You know, back then, everybody viewed it as sort of Christian America versus these godless atheist communists in the USSR. But now the tables have been totally turned against that. I've got a quote here from Putin. He said this back in December of 2013. Many Euro-Atlantic countries have moved away from their roots, including Christian values. Policies are being pursued that place on the same level a multi-child family and a same-sex partnership, a faith in God and a belief in Satan. This is the path of degradation. So a pretty powerful quote where he's just saying you cannot say that a same-sex partnership is on the same level as a family with a woman and a man and a woman and children. And then the very next month, Patriarch Kirill, he echoed those same sentiments. He said, Western powers are engaging in the spiritual disarmament of their people. We in Russia have been through an epoch of atheism, and we know what it is to live without God, and we want to shout to the whole world, stop. So I think that's just a remarkable statement. He's telling Europe and the United States to learn from the mistakes that the Soviet Union made. And you know, those mistakes were atheism and godlessness.
And what's interesting is that they're enforcing that view with the same kind of totalitarian thinking that made the Soviet Union such a menace.
That's right. And in all of this, Putin and Kirill are tapping into the deep-rooted hatred that many people around the world feel toward the West's embrace of promiscuity, of divorce, of feminism, of pornography, of homosexuality, mm-hmm. of abortion, and so on. So now this new court case with Viktor Krasnov, you know, it seems like kind of a small story, but it's a sign of the increasingly authoritarian direction that Putin is steering Russia into. And it also shows that Putin is hijacking religion to great effect. We hear about nations like Iran being Islamist, not Islamic, but Islamist, which means they're trying to push, force Islam onto people both inside and outside their borders. And now it almost seems like we could say that Russia is becoming Christianist in a way. And of course, that's a false Christianity. It's the Russian Orthodox Church. But it is interesting because history teaches us that there's no more potent or dangerous force to sway populations toward a geopolitical aim than religion. And that remains true in this modern world. Religion, as you mentioned at the beginning there, it's at the heart of all those ongoing conflicts in Africa and the Middle East. It's the main factor motivating Iran's really provocative foreign policy. And it's even somewhat below the surface. It is the coalescing force behind the seemingly secular European Union.
Well, in the first segment, we were just talking about the way that Americans are embracing Donald Trump after having embraced President Obama. Probably not the same Americans that embraced both, but this it is like as the world gets more dangerous, there is this desire to look to a strong man, and we were talking about just how much that is infiltrating, or how much we're seeing that same trend playing out, or about to, or certainly the climate is being created for that to happen in Europe. But in a way, Russia is a kind of the best example of this, where you've already got a guy in power who is really adept at harnessing public support, using whatever tools he has at his disposal. Religion is a huge tool in that arsenal. And, you really, like, looked at from a historical standpoint, you wouldn't think of it. Certainly recent history, you wouldn't think of Russia as using religion in that way. But Putin knows what he's doing.
He's a brilliant leader. And it is important to remember that the Russian Orthodox Church has about 90 million members outside of Russia. They're mostly in former Soviet states. So if all of these people want to be good Christians, they will support Putin, even if Putin wants to turn their nation into a client state to Russia. The way Putin has hijacked religion, basically it means that these 90 million people really need to support whatever he does, even if it's at the expense of the autonomy of their nation. So it's a brilliant thing and a very significant trend for us to keep an eye on, I think.
We've been talking with trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques. He wrote an article a couple of years back called "Does Vladimir Putin Have God on His Side?" regarding Ukraine. He was talking about this trend in its earlier stages. It's reaching a more advanced level now, today. But you can find that article online at thetrumpet.com. We appreciate you bringing this story to us, Jeremiah. Thanks.
Great to be with you.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Have you ever reached down to pick something up off the floor, leaned over to tie your shoes, and you feel this sharp, sudden pain in your lower back? What happened there? Well, we're going to talk with a chiropractor who has some tips on how to figure out how serious is this problem, what can I do to get myself working again. We're going to talk to Dr. Larry Lowen. How are you doing, Larry?
Hello, Mr. Hilliker. Doing well, thanks.
Dr. Larry. So, yeah, you probably see people who have this situation all the time, if they can get off the floor and make their way into your office. But you've got some tips for how the person could help themselves right there in their own home.
Yeah, you know, prevention is the key. And oftentimes what's asked is, how can I prevent these problems? There's the doing the preventative exercise. But when somebody has this acute low back situation, it catches them often off guard. They're usually someplace between at home and work or either at both. And so it's one of the most immobilizing types of pain that bring people in. It's probably the number one driver of what catches people from the house straight over to the medical doctor's office, over to my office. And there's some really simple practical tips we can all learn and remember in order to prevent this thing from even happening, and not necessarily having to go through a whole list of core exercises or low back strengthening exercises, but they are important and it does add to this. But there's a couple tips I have here too that I think are just more relevant and seem to stick with folks who have come into my office.
Okay, what you got for us, Dr. Larry?
So if you reached forward to grab that pencil and you felt that sharp pain in your low back, and sometimes people will tell me that they're flopping like a fish on the floor, or they happen to catch themselves midway down and they're locked in that position, the first thing you want to do is get off your feet and ice it. You want to ice it for 20 minutes. So no matter where you're at, if you can get an ice pack, that's perfect. If you can't, then just get off your feet. It gets a swelling off the lower spine pretty quick. And then what you want to do is try to find a comfortable position while you're icing it for the remainder of the day. And so, you know, if it happens on the weekend at home, the rule of thumb is to ice it on the hour every hour for 20 minutes. Find that comfortable position off your feet while you're icing. And so it helps with that game of pressure, because that's typically what happens instantly is the back swells up. You get pressure on certain structures in the lower spine, and that causes the pain, sometimes muscle spasms and leg pain. So that's the first tip.
You're going to need a friend for this, I would think, right? If you're on the floor, you got to get someone to help you with the ice.
Yeah, either that or you got to be a very good crawler. And so since we all started crawling, we have some experience in that category. But, you know, with two elbows dug into the floor and shifting forward, sometimes you can get yourself to your feet or to your couch.
Commando style, yeah.
But, all right. Try to do both. Some people have a spouse or a sibling around that can help, but if you're on your own, you're on your own. You got to deal with it. So it'd be to get off your feet. And sometimes it just means rolling over on your side on the floor, depending on, again, the severity of the situation, and letting kind of, you know, figure out what happened first, reassess it quickly. And then if you can get, you know, close to a couch or something like that, that's the best thing. And then, of course, get to an ice pack. So the icing and off your feet is key for the first round. And then the second thing, this is kind of the opposite, is once you've iced it at least once or maybe twice, you want to try to get up and actually try to shuffle and walk around. So while you want to get off your feet quickly, after you ice and get some swelling down, you want to get you back up on your feet. And in most cases, unless it's a severe lower spine problem like a herniated disc, most people can get up on their feet and start to shuffle around. That would just be, you know, a flat ground area. Because what that does is it provides a little bit more balance to an injured spine while you're reducing the pressure.
Okay, so actually getting moving, this I would imagine might not be the most comfortable thing, but actually moving is the best thing to do.
Yeah, I have had the benefit of talking to, you know, orthopedic and neurospine surgeons throughout the years of just doing acute low back cases and chronic low back cases. And the one thing, obviously, is the acute part is get the swelling down first, is what we talk about. But to mobilize, so long as there's not some more severe injury, and everybody thinks they have the worst severe injury when they injure themselves like this because it feels that way. But in most cases, it's just coming from a basic strain or pulled back. And so if you can get that swelling down for that first 20 minutes to stand up and walk around or shuffle around even a little bit, even if you're leaning to one side, it will help keep the back warm in a way and keep the back muscles from tightening up too much. So shuffling around in between ice sessions is key. And at work too, if your boss or if you own your own business, if you're able to kind of get up in between, you know, phone calls or emails, that's where it's helpful as well too, you know, the practical setting.
All right. So help me to understand this. We're icing it and it's making it cold, but you're wanting to keep it warm at the same time through mobility.
Yeah, it's an awkward balance of factors that works. and in the most practical way possible, because again, you're really competing against two things here. You have an acute injury that causes swelling, but it also causes the muscles to tighten and grab you. Now, part of these are protective mechanisms, so they are good, and you want to work with them. So let me give you the quick example. When people go to the medical doctor with this, typically they hit them with anti-inflammatories and muscle relaxants, but that ramps it up too quick, and what it does is it disables some of the body's inherent protective mechanisms, and so you get an automatic quick reduction of inflammation and swelling, an automatic shutdown of the muscle tension, and now you got a back that's even more vulnerable. So really what we're doing is we're working with two competing factors here and working with them.
All right. Does that make sense? Yeah. So we got two out of the three out of the way, the third tip you got for us.
So the third tip, and this is where you will need a partner, although there's some people that have come into my office that have told me about some very creative things in order to do this on their own, is you want to, in between eye sessions and the walking, when you have a chance, you want to lay down, can be whatever way is comfortable, and have somebody gently pull on your legs. And what that does is it provides a little bit of traction for the lower spine. So somebody would come over, kind of take your ankles and just give it a nice little tug or a 2 to 5 pound pressure pull, just to lean a little bit. And that drives or takes some pressure away from the lower spine. It's a form of traction that we physical therapists and chiropractors do in our office all day long. But you can have a partner do it. And if you can't, if you don't have a partner, there are ways around that. I live in the Upper Peninsula here in the North Woods, and there's been guys that have told me they've taken their deer blinds, they've strapped like ropes to the bottom of their deer blinds because they had to go deer hunting, and they've leaned against that rope and pulled away from it. That's what they did all day long. So again, that's very creative, not recommended, but if you got a partner or a spouse or something around, that light little pull on the legs can help. And that those three things, typically, if you can do one, two, or all three in some way, shape, or form, will yield you, and this is really astounding, 5 to 15% relief per day, every single day, until you're finally out of the complete awful pain within a short amount of time. And that's the most natural way to heal it, on your own.
All right, so pulling on the leg, what, a few seconds at a time, how many times?
You know, I like to use rules of fives and tens. It seems 5-second holds, 5 repetitions, intermittently throughout the day. It's a practical way to handle it. There's no other format to follow other than you can do too much or you can do not enough. And so that rule of 5 and 10 seems to work just in the regular setting.
All right. So at the beginning, you were talking about prevention. What can you do to most people, they're not going to think about it until it actually happens to them. But just in terms of general, be nice to your back. What sort of tips do you have for us if we're not in acute pain?
So if we're not in acute pain, the first thing is to avoid the movement. The movement that typically sends people down to the floor with this particular situation is the tilt forward with the torso, 5 to 10 degrees, and the tilt to the left or right. So again, back to the pencil thing. You're on your way down to pick up a pencil off the floor. You tilt forward and you lean, or you're going to tie your shoe, or you're going to put on a sock. It's that tilt forward and lean with the torso. The back disengages its primary supporting structures, the ones that keep us upright and mobile, and you have failure. So I tell folks, don't do that movement. If you can avoid that one, and they say how, there's a simple practical way to remember this, is you lock and lean. So you lock one arm, let's say into a thigh, so you hold your thigh, then you lean, so you're taking the center of gravity away from your lower spine onto another area that's not as vulnerable.
You're grabbing your own leg before you lean down?
Exactly. It's just a way to redirect the center of gravity away from the lower spine onto, you know, let's say your elbow, your wrist, and then your thigh. So you're taking that pressure, you're leaning into it, and then you're going forward to pick up the pencil. And if you need to tie your shoe, obviously once you're finally down and you're in a safe landing and you're okay, then you can release the arm and tie your shoe. Unless you can tie your shoe with one hand, which would be amazing.
All right. Any other tips for us before we...
Yeah, the second thing was, so if you forget that and you're into the preventative exercise thing, there's the two schools of thought is strengthen your core and strengthen your low back. Strengthening your core can fall through in handling, you know, the main supporting muscles of the abdomen or stomach, which is, there's a whole slew of those, and anybody can Google those online, but basically your crunches, your leg lifts, and your obliques. Those are helpful. And again, I cited an example before to you. I've had fellows that have tried straight core exercises, and on certain types of chronic back problems, They tend to flare them up. And so a safe one to do for specifically the lower spine is something called the bird dog. The bird dog is something where you're just on four knees. I'm sorry, you're on all fours, so your hands and your knees.
Right.
And you lift your left arm and your right leg up at the same time and then bring them down and switch. And what that does is it strengthens up that lower spine, those lower supporting structures, and helps prevent, you know, long-term problems. And so, you know, that's kind of your nuts and bolts way to A, avoid the injury itself, and B, how to prevent it by strengthening supporting structures.
Yeah, I've actually, whenever I've had a little bit of tenderness in my lower back, that bird dog exercise really helps a lot.
Yeah, it seemed like you were familiar with it, and it is the number one I give out here. Anybody can pretty much do it. If you've got bad knees, bad wrists, bad elbows, you can lay flat on your stomach on the bed, and so you can soften that up a little bit. So there's ways around it to get it done, and it does provide the most, you know, stability and support for the lower spine. And that kind of that's the full roundabout way in order to A, prevent an acute low back situation, and B, to strengthen those things. So even if you forget how to, you know, bend the proper way, the back hopefully will be strong enough to overcome it.
All right, we appreciate the advice, and we've been talking with Dr. Larry Loewen about what to do if your back gives you trouble when you go down to tie your shoe. Thanks a lot. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome.
It's time for today's last word.
For young people, the idea of marriage still holds considerable charm. Recent polls show that more than 80% of American high school seniors expect to get married, and 90% of those assume they'll remain wed to the same person for life. A survey of college students in England found 95% want to marry. And among adults who've never been married, 61% want to be, according to a Pew poll from a few years back. But the dreams of marriage are failing to materialize for more and more of these people. In 1960, 72% of American adults were married. Today, that number has dropped to 51%. In 1960, 15% had never married. Today, that's 28%. In 1970, 4 out of 5 25 to 29-year-old men were married. Now it's half that, 2 out of 5. What's going on? People want to marry, but they're not marrying. Why is that? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but sociologists have identified one that I find particularly interesting. It is that today's men, at least in the eyes of today's women, aren't qualified. As Hannah Rosen wrote in her book, The End of Men and the Rise of Women, the men may cling to traditional ideals about themselves as providers, but they are further than ever from being able to embody those ideals. Every year in America, 170,000 more women than men get bachelor's degrees. And while the average man still earns 10% more than the average woman, among 20-somethings, women now have the edge in the wage gap. Men who hold the advantage in education and earning power are a dying breed. The numbers of well-educated, financially self-sufficient women are mushrooming beyond the numbers of men who could be described that way. In fact, men are trending in the opposite direction. Today, for example, we see the highest percentage ever recorded of men of prime working age who aren't even working. About 1 in 5, 1/5 of men. Compare that to 1950, when it was 1 in 20. In an Atlantic article a few years back, Kate Bolick wrote, "Recent years have seen an explosion of male joblessness and a steep decline in men's life prospects that have disrupted the romantic market in ways that narrow a marriage-minded woman's options. Increasingly, her choice is between deadbeats, whose numbers are rising, and playboys, whose power is growing." Well, who are these women going to marry? The bar for what they want out of marriage is climbing, while the field is getting worse. Unsurprisingly, more and more of them are resigning themselves to the idea that their best option is to just skip marriage altogether. You know, they'd love to marry if the right man showed up, but in their view, in the end, marriage is unnecessary. I can take care of myself. I don't need a man to support me. He'd just be another person to take care of, another mouth to feed. Bullock laments, as women have climbed ever higher, men have been falling behind. We've arrived at the top of the staircase, ready finally to start our lives, only to discover a cavernous room at the tail end of a party, most of the men gone already, some having never shown up, and those who remain are leering by the cheese table or are, you know, the ones you don't want to go out with. The question is on the lips of women everywhere. What's wrong with all these guys? Most people can agree there's a problem, but far fewer recognize its full scope. When you talk to the women and you meet the men, when you read the stories and you look at the data, you begin to realize Bullock is not describing a minor irritant or a disappointment that a few women share. She is chronicling the collapse of a social order. Social historian Stephanie Kuntz says that we're experiencing nothing less than, quote, a historical revolution every bit as wrenching, far-reaching, and irreversible as the Industrial Revolution. As she told The Atlantic, when it comes to what people actually want and expect from marriage and relationships and how they organize their sexual and romantic lives, all the old ways have broken down. If you examine it, this breakdown in all the old ways, virtually all traces back to the trashing of the traditional roles of men and of women, particularly that of breadwinner and homemaker. Historically, what drove men's march through the milestones to adulthood was the expectation that they would fulfill the role of provider. For generations, this commonly recognized duty propelled men into the workforce. It often served as a prod to men's ambitions, and it did a lot to shape society. Even today, it remains a strong motivation to any young man who accepts it. And women recognize their responsibility to make the home an inviting, nurturing environment for children to be reared toward adulthood. For two generations now, esteem for those roles has been fading to the point where today they are ignored, if not treated with contempt. In dismantling the traditional ways of relating to one another as men and women, society lost more than just human traditions. We arrogantly, foolishly trashed God's design in creating men and women. The failings that have resulted vividly illustrate the wisdom in God's original design. For the sake of order and harmony, God created men to fulfill one role within the family and within society, and He created women to fill a different and beautifully complementary role. This is the reality that God created and revealed to humankind. It's a vital key to individual, family, and societal success. The reason for marriage is far greater than most people realize. Marriage has an awesome purpose. If you want to understand this purpose, I want to encourage you to go to thetrumpet.com, click on the literature tab, and find our booklet, Why Marriage Soon Obsolete. Not only will it help you understand marriage's purpose, it will show you why the old ways will never die. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like the analysis you hear, we want to give you a free subscription to the Trumpet magazine. The voices that you hear on this program are the writers of this exceptional monthly news magazine. To receive The Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. We also have articles posted there daily, reporting and analyzing the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Andrew Miller, Jeremiah Jacques, and Larry Lowen. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And in honor of the launch this week of Dennis Leap's new program, Just the Best Literature, I'll leave you with this thought from Mark Twain. The man who does not read good books has no advantage over the man who cannot read them. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.